Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 4:30 p.m. That is New York time, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, this has certainly been a week that could be characterized as eventful, and there is plenty to talk about. And particularly in view of the fact that Jay Powell today gave the first, I think, evidence, or at least gave the first indication that there is a Powell put behind the markets. And this is what the market has been waiting for, because every single central banker in the US since the time of Greenspan has been tested by the market. And what the market wants to know is whether the Fed is going to ride to the rescue in the event of real strife. Well, since the last Fed meeting, the market has been selling off aggressively, and we can see the rally that has taken place in Treasury futures, going from 118 to 123 in the space of approximately 6 weeks, is a pretty significant move. And today's downward dynamic is the first indication that momentum is starting to wane in terms of that demand for risk-off assets or safe haven assets. So this is significant because we have had an unrequiting bid underway for safe haven assets for the last 6 weeks, and that has put downward pressure on risk assets like commodities and stocks. And there has been a very clear bearish bias to what we've seen in terms of the stock market. So it is important now to start to think about exactly where are we? Is this a low, or is it the low for this market? So this is the most profound question I think most people are going to be asking right now. I think that it is worth looking at a number of charts and then starting to piece together exactly what it is the market is trying to tell us in here. Well, the other thing that we had in here today, well, let's first examine what it was that Jay Powell had to say. What he said was that the Fed can be patient, that they are data dependent. And there was, of course, some data on which to base that claim in here today. The first was that earnings, our average hourly earnings on a year-over-year basis, remain at approximately 3.2%. And this is an index. I have to download the history for this index independently every time it's updated because it is revised so often. But what is important here is that the rate of hourly earnings increasing has remained stable above 3% for the last three reporting periods. So that's quite encouraging, but it's also contributing to the rise in wages. Now, in normal circumstances, that would be considered to be inflationary, and we haven't yet seen clear evidence of inflation, although, of course, there has been plenty of evidence of inflation in asset prices and indeed in the cost of living for what people actually spend their money on. But of course, that's not how the Fed actually calculates inflation. So that's, of course, another point that when the Fed says it's data dependent, well, then it's not on the data that we might, as regular individuals, consider to be efficacious, but rather what they think is worthy of consideration. So we have to at least start to think about what it is that they're looking at. Well, they're looking certainly they're looking at the wage growth as being something that they're keeping an eye on, but inflation is not picking upwards, so that's something that they are also looking at. The inflation measure is give or take around where they are comfortable, so they don't feel that they're under pressure to cut rates. The stock market and the bond markets have been telling them that they are potentially making a mistake here. And well, in fact, the stock and bond markets have been very clearly signaling that they are making a mistake. Of course, time will tell that by raising rates and by reducing the size of the balance sheet simultaneously, this is introducing unknowns. An analyst I was, or a report I was reading earlier on today was comparing this to a science experiment and saying, well, in one of the things that you're taught, 101 in a science class in high school, is that you don't change two variables at the same time. And that's not particularly scientific. And that's exactly what the Fed is doing. And there's no question that this monetary policy environment we've had over the last 9 years has definitely been an experiment. So we're definitely in uncharted territory in here. And what the market needs to know is that the Fed has got some awareness of the pressures that it is inflicting by adopting a dual or a simultaneous dual policy tightening enterprise. So this is obviously something that is worth considering. Then, of course, one of the things that they will be looking at as well is that manufacturing data has been contracting. And this is not simply the case in the USA, but it is coming back down from the upper side of the range. Well, you can see from the data that this is a very volatile sector and that it's prone to volatility because manufacturing tends to be inherently cyclical. So manufacturing activity or purchasing managers' activity is coming back down. So unemployment or the employment, the jobs report came in very strongly today. It was the best figure we've seen in 10 months. But when we think about the jobs figure, it's not exactly a it's not a leading indicator. Purchasing managers' activity is a leading indicator because when purchasing managers are making decisions about buying more stuff, well, then their attitudes to the growth of their businesses is improving, and that's when they decide, well, then we probably need to also hire new workers. Well, when they're ordering less stuff, they're less likely to be ordering new workers. So then that's, I think, more important here, that what we're, I think that is the most important thing that we've seen in here today. It's not so much that we had a strong jobs report, even though that's exactly what they've been talking about in the financial media, but rather what Jay Powell had to say has been behind this reversal that we've had, for example, in bonds, and then this powerful rally that's taken place on the stock market. Well, if we look at, for example, the S&P 500, it was up in excess of 3% in here today. And this is a very clear countermanding upper dynamic relative to that weakness that we saw yesterday. Well, this is potentially, as long as the low yesterday holds, a higher reaction low, which is the most basic fundamental premise for a recovery. But when we look at this on a longer term basis, well, let's try and explain this chart to a blind person. Well, we can see that there are a number of consistency characteristics. So the first is that it was really quite depressed in 2009, and then we had a very impressive rebound. The index just about doubled in between 2009 and 2010. Then we went into a choppy advance, and the market was still going upwards, but not in a particularly consistent manner. Then from 2013 through to 2015, it did go up in a very consistent manner. There was one wobble at the end of 2014 that contributed to a loss of momentum. Then we had some more significant pullbacks towards the second half of 2015. We had a lower low at the beginning of 2016. But price was able to rebound, and subsequently it went into a particularly consistent advance, much more consistent in fact than what we saw between 2012 and 15. There was some evidence of acceleration at the end of 2017 that contributed to a large pullback and a very swift reversion back to the mean. The progression of higher reaction lows was still intact until approximately September of 2018. Then the index pulled back. It ranged in the region of, but mostly below, the trend mean for the first time really since 2015 and 16, and then broke lower, so that the full extent of the decline from the failed breakout to new highs in approximately September to the lows we saw just before Christmas has been the biggest pullback we've seen in the context of what has effectively been a 9-year advance. Now, that's the biggest inconsistency we've seen, and it was following the most consistent period that we'd seen in the stock market. So, at the very minimum, this uptrend has had a major trend inconsistency. So, the burden of proof now has to rest with the bulls. The bulls have to demonstrate that the low can be held, then that it can put in a sequence of higher reaction lows, and most particularly push back above the trend mean. Now, considering that this is a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and the speed of the decline has been on making headlines all over the world, well, it is quite normal that we would have a period of right-hand extension following this kind of move. That generally allows the oversold condition relative to the trend mean to be unwound. And it's at that point that the really big questions are asked, because then the index is either going to push back up above the trend mean, hold it, and move on to successive new highs, and reassert the medium term, indeed the long term bull market, or it's going to fail in the region of the trend mean, pull back down to the lower side of the range, and break lower. Alternatively, we could be in for, so those are two potential scenarios. The third, of course, is that we could be in for a potentially lengthy period of ranging, which could contribute to valuations coming back down as the as earnings growth moderates, but the earnings themselves remain relatively high, and that the price simply goes sideways. Well, that's a potential outcome, particularly in view of the fact that we are seeing the normalization of interest rates, and that could act as a headwind to stock markets for a while if central banks do in fact go ahead with it. And that is very much an open question, because the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet, and they are unlikely to veer from that particular course of action in the short term. They want to try and normalize their policy before they have to engage in clear remedial action with the next recession. So that's something that's very clearly out there. But what the stock market is telling us is that there has been a major trend inconsistency, and that we have seen nothing like this, or even remotely like this, since at least 2015 and 2016, and that's a best case scenario. So what is it that was going on back in 2015 and 2016 that then contributed to the additional rally that we had in between 2016 and the beginning of 2018? Well, one important parallel that we have now with then has been the run-up that we've seen in high yield spreads. You can see very clearly in 2015 and 16, high yield spreads had broken out to new highs and then failed to sustain the breakout. Now, that was in direct response to the fact that the ECB intervened and said that they would do whatever was necessary to rescue the euro and flooded the market with 2.6 trillion euros. And 1 trillion euros, even in today's money, is still a lot of money, and that bought this impressive advance in asset prices that we've seen since. Well, I've been highlighting this chart of the central bank balance sheets that I compiled a few years ago on almost every broadcast. And what we've seen is that since 2015, that you can see, for example, in 2014 and 2015, the pace of the advance moderated. It pretty much went sideways. And then at the beginning of 2016, it accelerated again, and it went from approximately 15.5 trillion to almost 21 trillion. So the central banks of the world added an additional $5 trillion of liquidity to the market in the period between 2016 and 2018, in March 2018. And since then, on a dollar-adjusted basis, they have been withdrawing liquidity. Well, there are two important facts that have contributed to this contraction. The first is that the Federal Reserve is removing liquidity from the market by reducing the size of its balance sheet. Not only that, but that the interest that they're paying on excess reserves held at the Fed has also been cut back since the summer of 2018. They're paying 10 basis points less than the Fed funds rate for excess reserves, so banks are withdrawing their excess reserves. But they're not lending out at nearly the same pace that they were before. Well, there are two particular reasons for this. The first is that their capital requirements are higher under MiFID II, so they have to hold treasuries. But even though the deposits that are at the Fed are obviously guaranteed by the government, and so are treasuries, well, there is a big difference, though, in that the reserves you put with the Fed don't moderate in value, whereas treasury prices go up and down. So by switching your reserves from the central bank to the bond markets, you are exposing the bank to greater risk. That means that from day to day, they need to hold more money, which means that they have less to lend out, simply to allow for the volatility in the value of their holdings. Then, of course, there is the simple fact of the matter that banks are less engaged today in the mortgage markets. In fact, it is non-bank lenders are the biggest mortgage providers in the USA these days. But then you have the fact that because there is greater risk in the banking sector as a result of this change in the way that interest is being paid on their excess reserves, that's contributing to LIBOR rates rising. And this is a very clear uptrend. And what's, I think, most particularly interesting here is that LIBOR rates have been rising persistently since 2015. They're at almost 2.8% now. And despite the fact that we've seen a meaningful rally in terms of the price of government bond yields in here over the last 6 weeks, LIBOR rates continue to expand. So that tells us that there is continued stress in the bond market, in the financial sector, and that this is still a tight liquidity environment. Well, I think it is worth then also looking at some of these banking sectors. So, for example, the S&P 500 Banks Index was certainly in positive territory in here today. It was up 10 points. That's almost a 3% move on a 300-point index. And it certainly has a short-term oversold condition, and it is looking increasingly likely that that short-term oversold condition is going to be unwound. Well, the regional banks are a much better representation of what's going on in the domestic economy, and they have also got a short-term oversold condition to unwind, and they're now coming back up towards the upper, the underside of that overhead trading range. Well, when we look at a global banks index, this index is compiled of all SIFIs, the systemically important banks, and it is also rallying in here, but this has been a very persistent decline, and the size of the rallies are relatively equal sized. So this is the most recent counter trend rally. It's going to have to do more than just simply rally on 1 week in order to really demonstrate we're back in a demand dominated environment beyond the short term. And most particularly, it'll have to break back up and into the overhead trading range and then back above the trend mean in order to really demonstrate that some of the pressure is coming off of the banking sector. Well, it is the European banks in particular are weighing on this index. And even here, we've seen that there is at least initial evidence that the Eurostoxx Banks Index is demonstrating some support at the lower side of what is effectively an almost 10-year range. But there's still a sequence of lower rally highs, and there are some profound challenges in the European banking sector because they completely fudged the opportunity they had to write off bad loans, and they're still sitting on the banks of our, on the balance sheets of European banks. That's equally true of both creditor and debtor nations. Then when we look at the Chinese banking sector. Well, the Chinese cut their reserve requirements by a full percent in here today. So that's, I'll put the chart up in a moment. But what is particularly interesting is that the Chinese banks had been holding a very clear sequence of higher reaction lows from the middle of last year until December, and then they broke down. Well, we're starting to see the first evidence starting to come through again of some state support for the sector, and the China reserve requirement cut is something that is designed to really lend some support to the banking sector. Well, if we look at this over the long term, the measure hit a peak back in 2011 at 21.5%, and it's now at 14.5%. Well, if they lop another 1% off, it'll be 13.5%. So by international standards, that's still very high. But on the other hand, Chinese banks don't want to lend out money for the simple reason that there's a lot more uncertainty with regard to the Chinese economy today than there was before. And cutting reserve requirements, and they've been cutting reserve requirements all year, at least for the last 12 months. They've lopped approximately 3% off the requirements. That hasn't encouraged the banking sector to get out there and start lending. Well, there are two reasons. One is the uncertainty in the economy, and of course the other one is that China is now allowing defaults. Well, it's one thing to be to make loans with abandon when you know that the central bank is going to step in and rescue you if the debtor goes belly up. It's quite another to accept default risk, and that's the prospect that the financial sector in China now has to deal with when they never really had to deal with it before. So then, of course, you have the rationalization that's going on in terms of fixed asset investment businesses in China, which, whether that is the property market, the cement market, where there's massive overcapacity, aluminium or copper, particularly aluminium has got massive overcapacity as well. Then you have the coal-fired power stations, which are also being rationalized. So when they say go out and lend, well, then the banks have got to be saying to whom, because there is so much pressure coming on the traditional sources of credit demand that this is a very uncertain environment, an uncertain environment for the banking sector. And then the retail sector has seen a significant pullback in terms of their appetite for consumer goods. So that's part of the reason why Apple has pulled back so violently, because they are essentially pricing themselves out of a market where demand for their products has been declining because they're not sufficiently better than the previous iterations, and they are significantly more expensive. So Apple is essentially turning itself into a luxury goods brand, but one of the hallmarks of luxury goods is scarcity of supply, and that is not at all what Apple is accustomed to. So this is a business model question, and I think that the blame for this hiccup, or I think it's probably more than a hiccup for Apple, because they don't have a pipeline of new products, and certainly nothing on the scale of the iPhone. Well, there is another company that was castigated for not having a lineup of new products, which was Microsoft, and it needed a new CEO to really reinvigorate the attitude towards it. So, therefore, perhaps Tim Cook has to go, and that could potentially be something that could reinvigorate the attitude towards the shares of Apple. Well, we can see, for example, that with Microsoft, It was out in the wilderness for an awfully long time after Bill Gates left, and it wasn't until they got a new CEO that things really started to get going, and now it is the largest company in the world and has firmed from the region of the trend mean. Well, this also helps to demonstrate that it isn't every company has been deteriorating, that there are a significant number, although it is a comparatively small number, that have been able to hold the region of their trend means and remain in reasonably consistent advances. Well, the kinds of companies that have done better generally fall into two big categories. One is those that are clearly highly defensive, and those are particularly the utilities or the consumer staples companies, are the kinds of companies that tend to prevail regardless of what the background is, for the simple reason that they've got very secure business models. And whether those are because of the subscription business model, which Microsoft has, or because they are essential to modern living, whether you consider that to be the case for your particular lifestyle or not, with McDonald's or Coca-Cola is beside the point. They have very clear business strategies. Nestle, everyone thinks about it in terms of coffee and chocolate, but bottled water is the most most popular packaged good in America today, for example, and the share is firming from the region of the trend mean. But of course, these are highly defensive sectors. Now, when we think about the wider outlook here, then this is something that we need to pay particular attention to. So that's, I think, something that we can think about over the medium term, that these highly defensive sectors are doing better. So so that's when we think about these longer term scenarios, these are the kinds of companies that tend to do well in a late of the cycle in economy, but they also tend to do well when the global economy is expanding. So these are the kinds of companies that fall into the quality network. Well, the autonomies are generally speaking those that are most particularly attuned to that environment, because they are those kinds of companies that have got truly global businesses, that they have got an oligarchy status because they dominate their respective sectors. And oligarchy is, I think, a designation that encompasses quality and also encompasses what people in the technology sector regard as a moat. And it is these kinds of companies that have been prevailing right now. So Microsoft and Nestle and McDonald's certainly fit into that category. But if we then spin it out and think about, for example, in compressed gases, then Lind and Air Liquide dominate this, and Praxair dominate this market. Now, that's not the... just put up Air Liquide. We think about the outlook for the autonomies, well, they have certainly not been immune to the selling pressure that's been going on. And of course, part of the reason for that is because they are some of the largest companies in the world. Well, when we think about this environment where it has been, large companies have been pulling back, but it is large companies which also have got some of the biggest moats around their business, and they dominate the business models by having these very clear business models. Well, obviously, General Electric is also one of those. Well, what that also very clearly highlights is that the industrial sector in particular has been under incredible distress. Even in here, in with General Electric, it has been almost the worst performer last year nobody wanted to be seen holding it at the end of 2018, and that left nothing but potential buyers and bargain hunters at the beginning of this year. So that's something that is particularly, I think, just on a timing basis, that there is often a rotation that occurs at the end of the year out of the things that are most aggressively sold off. And then, of course, you have some of the companies like Boeing that did spectacularly well in 2017. And now they have moved into this much more volatile trading environment. Well, we had the failed upside breaks. We had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. A period of right-hand extension is now underway. I think anyone with eyes can see that this is a potentially evolving top formation. And it absolutely needs to push back above the trend mean in order to clearly demonstrate a return to demand dominance. So this is a more uncertain environment than, for example, we see with some of the other shares. But these are all autonomy type companies. It's not as if Boeing is going to disappear. But the big challenge to big global companies is that not only that do they have very strong cash flows, that's their positive, but that they're highly reliant on global growth. And then that has to bring us to the question of the trade war. Well, the big question is, does President Trump want to be re-elected? And I think anybody will see that he absolutely wants to be re-elected. Well, if that's the case, then he's going to have to find a way to declare victory in terms of the trade war. Whereas China's economy is slowing rather abruptly, and there is very clear evidence that it has been the loser so far in terms of this trade war. So it also needs to find a way out of it without losing face, and that's certainly not a very clear answer. The underperformance that we're seeing in the semiconductors index is, I think, the primary victim of what's going on in terms of the trade war. That there are two primary elements to the trade war. The first is protectionism on behalf of China, because they have excised so much of the big or the big global companies out of their market by imposing rules. The second is that China is doing whatever it can to boost its technological prowess. And that has extended to buying it or stealing it or developing it internally. But one way or the other, China is going to become a technological superpower, because they are going to spend whatever and do whatever it takes to get there. Well, that's a particular question for Taiwan, because the more pressure China feels on the challenges that they have in achieving their long-term goal of becoming a technological superpower, well, Taiwan has got all the manufacturing, it has all the expertise in terms of semiconductors in particular, and it's only right across the strait. China has long had its eye on reclaiming Taiwan, and there is a potential flashpoint there. Will the US in fact go to war to protect Taiwan? That is an awfully big question. Well, the stock market is likely to bounce on Monday, and it really does need to push back above the 10,000 level in order to demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. But that does represent a big question for Taiwan, because that is what could, I think, in any circumstances be regarded as a black swan that is not at all, I think, really understood by markets, that at some stage, if China feels under real pressure, then they could be forced or feel forced that they will have to take matters into a more direct appeal. And if we think about historically, why is it that countries go to war? Well, usually, historically at least, it's been to gain either political advantage or plunder. And Taiwan in particular represents a very pretty bauble indeed. Well, That also highlights that we are in a more sensitive geopolitical environment. And part of the reason that we are in that, and I think it is perhaps the guiding principle behind it, is because of oil prices. Well, oil today was up $1.50. Now, this is the biggest rally we've seen since prices failed to sustain the move above $80, and that, I think, helps to suggest that we are back in the potential for a reversionary rally, at least back up towards the mean, which could be effectively another $11 from where the price is at present. Then, if it puts, it will need to put in a higher reaction low, and we'll need to see what happens from then. But it does look like we're going to see an additional rally from here. But if we look at this over the much longer term basis, oil prices have been ranging for approximately 10 years, and they are today a fraction of where they were back in 2011 through 2014. So that's something that I think rather important here, that oil prices are in a secular bear market. They're no longer trending higher. And we start to see demand destruction and above $80. And an awful lot of additional supply starts to come online above $80. And the really big game-changing event of unconventional supply isn't so much the excess supply that we're getting, but rather that supply can be tailored to the available price. The early peak rates for unconventional wells means that by drilling more, you get more oil, and drilling less, you get less. So they can tailor their supply situation to the environment presented by them, by the oil price. The fact that this excess supply situation has virtually created an environment where the USA is energy independent or darn close to it, well, that means that they don't have to have, then it's a choice of whether they want to play the global police force when there is increasing energy security at home. It wasn't so much a choice when the US was the biggest importer of energy in the world, whereas today that is just not the case. So that sense of protectionism is, or the, are not so much protectionism, but nationalism, and the desire to no longer venture out into the world is a direct result of the fact that energy supply has been booming at home. Well, of course, the one country that has got a clear vested interest in ensuring that it has energy security is China. So they're building a daisy chain of military bases along the route from the Middle East to China, whether that is in Pakistan or Sri Lanka, Myanmar, or in the islands, and I think islands has to be in inverted commas, that have been militarized within the South China Sea. That's all aimed at securing the supply chain for its energy needs. China is a major energy importer, and that's not going to change anytime soon. Well, it's also part of the reason why they have got such a clear desire to have battery technology. So CATL, which is the world's largest battery manufacturer and is set to dwarf the supply coming out of Tesla over the next few years, has been rather range bound since it initially IPO'd just about 9 months ago. Well, that's a very clear difference in terms of the performance to the rest of the Chinese stock market. This is where the growth is in terms of China. China has got a very clear ambition to become energy independent, and the only possible way that they can do that is to go for energy storage and less oil consumption. And batteries are a very big part of that. So more than any other country, China is going to be both investing in production and development of new battery technology. And that is undeniable. It's something that is likely to form the basis of their technology-focused drive over the course of the next few years. Well, the other big thing that China is trying to evolve is biotechnology. And we've had a major merger in here this week. So that is starting to light the fire under the biotechnology sector, and the Nasdaq Biotech Index was up in a very dynamic manner in here this week. And it really did need that rally. Now, this is now at least testing the lower side of that overhead trading range. If we get follow through next week, it'll be pushing back up into the overhead trading range. But if it can push back above the trend mean, then I think there's a realistic possibility that we're going to start to see the biotech sector take on a position of outperformance once more. And that is also worth considering that, or what is worth considering is that biotech has been going sideways for 4 years already. This is not exactly what we're seeing, for example, with Apple. Apple is probably going to range, and that's in a best-case scenario, for a prolonged period before it can regroup and start to rally once more. Well, when we think about where we are, and to just go back to the initial question that we had at the beginning of this broadcast, let's look at the yield curve spread. Well, it's currently around 17 basis points, but this is the 2 and 10 year part of the spread. If we look at shorter denominations and shorter parts of the curve, then they have already inverted. For example, when we look at the TIPS spread, then it was inverted in the middle of last year. If we look at the swap spread, then we're also presented with an inverted, I haven't got the exact spread between 2s and 10s for the swap spread, but I know that it did invert this week. So what we're presented with is a tightening liquidity environment, and bull markets thrive on liquidity. So this is an environment that is not quite the same as 2015 and 2016, but not far off it either. That the bigger pullback we had in 2015 and 2016 was in a response to tightening liquidity, and that's exactly what we're having today. So that's, I think, a very significant outcome here, that we are at a point where there is going to have to be a big choice made by central banks. Are they going to normalize policy? Well, Europe and Japan are a long way from doing that. When we look at, for example, the Eurostoxx or the Europe Stoxx 600, it's been ranging below 400 for 18 years already, and it has just pulled back from the upper side of that range again. Well, this is the broad European index. What we can certainly say is that within Europe, it is the Eurozone has been the real problem child. And the Eurostoxx is significantly below the peaks posted in 2000 and in 2007. And it is coming now down towards the most recent of the higher reaction lows, but certainly not in certainly doesn't have the same kind of consistency in terms of its trend. But nonetheless, it is taking its cue from Wall Street, and it did rally in here today. So there is the potential that it will unwind its short-term oversold condition relative to the trend mean. So we are definitely getting a position today, if we think about it in terms of just short, medium, or long term, that we have got a risk-on environment starting as of today, for sure. Or one might argue that it really kicked off on the 26th of December. So we're now back in a risk-on environment, because this today was the first evidence that we started to see some of the safe haven assets coming under pressure? Well, gold prices have been rallying over the course of the last few weeks. They are now above the trend mean and above the psychological $1,250 area, but it's going to have to hold that move during this during what is likely to be a consolidation. Platinum prices were up $27 in here today. This is the biggest move we've seen in quite some time, and they're rallying from around this $800 area. Well, platinum has been about the most unloved of all the precious metals over the last few years, and part of the reason for that is because of the lack of demand for catalytic converters. So that's certainly a change in terms of the environment. Copper prices, which had been selling off rather aggressively, were in positive territory in here today, up 7.5 cents. So that's confirming support in the region of the lows posted back in August and September. So there's the scope here, if we get further follow through on the upside next week, that is going to at least signify a failed downside break and potentially go back up and test the upper side of this overhead trading range. When we think about the bond markets, well, we had a significant move today in terms of the 10-year Treasury yield. And this is the first evidence that some supply is starting to come back into the market around the 2.5% level. Well, 2.5% was where had been an area of resistance for this chart all the way between 2015 and 2016 and 17. So it's a natural area where we might see some supply starting to come back in. Now the question is whether it's going to push back above the trend mean. So we've certainly got the scope in the short term for a risk-on environment, and that is likely to see a number of short-term oversold conditions to be unwound. Medium term, the much bigger question is about liquidity. When we think about all those charts we've looked at in terms of the liquidity situation, well, liquidity has been contracting. That there has been a champion for among central banks for supplying liquidity on a successive basis all the way through from 2009 until the summer of this year, and now we're looking for the next potential candidate to supply that liquidity. Well, it's unlikely to be the Federal Reserve, and then the question is whether it's going to be Europe. Europe does look like it's going to be the place where we're going to see the greatest potential for, I think, recessions to evolve. The end of the ECB's quantitative easing program was really particularly ill-timed, so that's something that is weighing on Europe generally. It's also the home of the most bonds that have got negative yields globally. So that's also a significant issue. Well, there is, I think, the realistic possibility that Europe may not engage in quantitative easing again, but that they will abandon the fiscal austerity regime that's been in place for the last decade. And that would be an additional sign of or an additional source of liquidity. China is trying to avoid a big fiscal stimulus. They're trying to avoid a big quantitative easing because they're afraid of the disruptive effect that it has on asset prices when they already have extraordinarily high asset prices. So they are going to go step by step, but there is a likelihood that they will avoid the quantitative easing and may just go for direct fiscal stimulus in a very targeted manner. But they're not going to have the same kind of, I think, stimulus with outright abandon that they had after 2008 again. Japan is never really stopped stimulating, but are they going to re-accelerate their efforts? Well, they're certainly not interested in seeing the yen appreciate, particularly following the move that we had yesterday. So That does look like a clear short in here that the Japanese certainly don't want a weak, strong currency. They're likely to do whatever is required to try and get that yen weaker from here. So that does look like a very clear reversal kind of situation in here, at least to unwind the yen's overbought condition. But Japan is unlikely to start printing again with very clear vigor. So then the big bets have got to be on the fiscal front, that the USA is already engaged in fiscal stimulus, that the UK is and France are doing the same thing. Italy is probably going to do the same thing, but probably won't talk about it in terms of its budget. Then, of course, you have Germany, and Germany probably needs it more than people realize. And you have then the potential for China to do the same. So these are important, potentially bullish factors for the global economy. Now, the medium term is where the risk resides, because it is in terms of this central bank policy where there is the potential for a mistake. And the Federal Reserve, both raising rates and reducing the size of its balance sheet simultaneously does have the potential to be a mistake. And the fact that we have seen such a significant pullback in what have been our in stock markets and the inconsistency that that represents means that we're going to have to see some form of remedial action in order to really start to muster support again and to rebuild confidence. So, certainly the medium term has seen a blow to confidence in here. So that's, I think, the risk. The fact that purchasing managers' indices are pulling back, the fact that China is underperforming in such a dynamic manner. I do think that the epicenter of risk is China and Europe, followed by the USA, and in that specific order, rather than the other way around. So that does suggest that it is China where we need to pay particular attention, because it is there that we're seeing declining standards of governance. It's also there where we have some of the clearest evidence of over leverage. So I think that's where the risks are. Now, long term, I do think that we're still in a secular bull market, that the pace of technological innovation is accelerating in an exponential manner. So that's a very significant outcome. Then we also have the clear improvement in governance in a significant number of major population centers. That is less about China today, because there was news today that there is an important think tank in China anticipates that their population will start contracting in 2030. India's population is still expanding, and 50% of the people are under 25 years old. Indonesia has also got improving governance, and Brazil is has got a new reform-minded administration. Quite whether they can deliver upon reform is an entirely different question. And then, of course, we have Africa, which is the global center for population growth and also has increasing evidence of improving governance. So that's an important designation, because the rise of the global consumer is something that creates demand for just about everything. So as long as we get improving standards of governance, then that is a bullish factor. Well, then we also have the potential that energy prices are not going to trend higher, that we then have the that is in itself something that lends a tailwind to growth. Then when we zoom in on that technological innovation, well, we have the rise of autonomy, we have the rise of artificial intelligence and the increasing commercialization of both those topics. We have immuno-oncology and the fact that Bristol Myers Squibb was buying Celgene to take a bigger bet on cancer treatment. That really does highlight where the profit centers for pharmaceutical companies are, but also that there are an increasing number of therapies that do in fact work. So that's something that is going to improve general productivity for the global economy. Well, then we also have to think about the fact that it's not simply about technological innovation, but the availability of that technology. That's one of the things that China is animating for, that they want to not only have access, but to be able to generate their own. But technology is generally available to the entire global population at this stage, and internet access is a major part of that. Well, that's also a big secular theme. So we have the very clear potential that we're going to have a confluence of events that are going to drive productivity growth over the long term. And what that really does suggest is that what we're getting in the short to medium term is that we're certainly in the short term, there's the potential for a rally. The medium term is that we're late in the cycle, so there's likely to be a recession somewhere and potentially more than one place at some point over the next year and a half. That is going to represent a hiccup and, I think, a medium-term correction for stock markets. And a medium-term correction could take anything from 6 months to a year and a half. And we're already a year into a medium-term correction. But it's after that point, when some of the excess has been blown off, that we see this secular bull market taking off again. And there will be new leadership. One of the things that we really keep an eye out for in terms of any big pullback is that we then see what is likely to be leading out of that pullback, because then that's going to give us an indication of what's going to lead in the next portion of the bull market. And certainly, it's probably a little bit early to be thinking about that just yet, but I think this is the time to be becoming alert to those cues. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.